Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005, and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died, and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So like, you could just see
100,000,
600,000
deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man. Let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for two straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back.
I'd like to tell you about the strangest secret in the world. Some years ago, the late Nobel Prize-winning Dr. Albert Schweitzer was being interviewed in London, and a reporter asked him, Doctor, what's wrong with men today? And the great doctor was silent a moment, and then he said, men simply don't think. It's about this that I want to talk with you. We live today in a golden age. This is an era that man has looked forward to, dreamed of, and worked toward for thousands of years. But since it's here, we pretty well take it for granted. We in America are particularly fortunate to live in the richest land that ever existed on the face of the earth, a land of abundant opportunity for everyone. But do you know what happens? Well, let's take 100 men who start even at the age of 25. Do you have any idea what will happen to those men by the time they're 65? These 100 men who all start even at the age of 25 believe they're going to be successful. If you ask any one of these men if he wanted to be a success, he'd tell you he did. And you'd notice that he was eager toward life, that there was a certain sparkle to his eye, an erectness to his carriage, and life seemed like a pretty interesting adventure to him. But by the time they're 65, one will be rich. Four will be financially independent. Five will still be working. 54 will be broke. Now think a moment. Out of the 100, only five make the grade. Now why do so many fail? What has happened to the sparkle that was there when they were 25? What's become of the dreams, the hopes, the plans? And why is there such a large disparity between what these men intended to do and what they actually accomplished? When we say about 5% achieve success, we have to define success. And here's the best definition I've ever been able to find. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. If a man is working toward a predetermined goal and knows where he's going, that man is a success. If he's not doing that, he's a failure. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. Rollo May, the distinguished psychiatrist, wrote a wonderful book called Man's Search for Himself. And in this book, he says, the opposite of courage in our society is not cowardice. It is conformity. And there you have the trouble today. It's conformity. People acting like everyone else without knowing why, without knowing where they're going. Now think of it. In America right now, there are over 18 million people, 65 years of age and older. And most of them are broke. They're dependent on someone else for life's necessities. Now, we learn to read by the time we're 7. We learn to make a living by the time we're 25. Usually by that time, we're not only making a living, we're supporting a family. And yet, by the time we're 65, we haven't learned how to become financially independent in the richest land that has ever been known. Why? We conform. And the trouble is that we're acting like the wrong percentage group, the 95 who don't succeed. Now, why do these people conform? Well, they really don't know. These people believe that their lives are shaped by circumstances, by things that happen to them, by exterior forces. They're outer-directed people. A survey was made one time that covered a lot of men, working men, and these men were asked, why do you work? Why do you get up in the morning? 19 out of 20 had no idea. If you ask them, they'll say, well, everyone goes to work in the morning, and that's the reason they do it, because everyone else is doing it. Now, let's get back to our definition of success. Who succeeds? The only person who succeeds is the person who is progressively realizing a worthy ideal. He's the person who says, I'm going to become this, and then begins to work toward that goal. I'll tell you who the successful people are. A success is the school teacher who's teaching school because that's what he or she wants to do. The success is the woman who's a wife and mother because she wanted to become a wife and mother and is doing a good job of it. The success is the man who runs the corner gas station because that was his dream. That's what he wanted to do. The success is the successful salesman who wants to become a top-notch salesman and grow and build with his organization. A success is anyone who is doing deliberately a predetermined job because that's what he decided to do deliberately. But only one out of 20 does that. That's why today there isn't really any competition unless we make it for ourselves. Instead of competing, all we have to do is create. You know, for 20 years, I looked for the key which would determine what would happen to a human being. Was there a key I wanted to know which would make the future a promise that we could foretell to a large extent? Was there a key that would guarantee a person's becoming successful if he only knew about it and knew how to use it? Well, there is such a key, and I've found it. Have you ever wondered why so many men work so hard and honestly without ever achieving anything in particular? And others don't seem to work hard and yet seem to get everything? They seem to have the magic touch. You've heard them say that about someone. Everything he touches turns to gold. And have you ever noticed that a man who becomes successful tends to continue to become successful? And on the other hand, have you noticed how a man who's a failure tends to continue to fail? Well, it's because of goals. Some of us have goals, some don't. People with goals succeed because they know where they're going. It's that simple. Think of a ship leaving a harbor, and think of it with the complete voyage mapped out and planned. The captain and crew know exactly where it's going and how long it'll take. It has a definite goal. Now, 9,999 times out of 10,000, it will get to where it started out to get. Now, let's take another ship, just like the first, only let's not put a crew on it or a captain at the helm. Let's give it no aiming point, no goal, no destination. We just start the engines and let it go. I think you'll agree with me that if it gets out of the harbor at all, it will either sink or wind up on some deserted beach at derelict. It can't go anyplace because it has no destination and no guidance, and it's the same with a human being. Take the salesman, for example. There's no other person in the world today with the future of a good salesman. Selling is the world's highest paid profession, if we're good at it and if we know where we're going. Every company needs top-notch salesmen, and they reward those men. The sky's the limit for them. But how many can you find? Someone once said the human race is fixed, not to prevent the strong from winning, but to prevent the weak from losing. The American economy today can be likened to a convoy in time of war. The entire economy is slowed down to protect its weakest link, just as the convoy had to go at the speed that would permit its slowest vessel to remain in formation. That's why it's so easy to make a living today. It takes no particular brains or talent to make a living and support a family today. So we have a plateau of so-called security, if that's what a person's looking for. But we do have to decide how high above this plateau we want to aim. Now let's get back to the strangest secret in the world, the story that I wanted to tell you today. Why do men with goals succeed in life and men without them fail? Well, let me tell you something which, if you really understand it, will alter your life immediately. If you understand completely what I'm going to tell you from this moment on, your life will never be the same again. You will suddenly find that good luck just seems to be attracted to you. The things you want just seem to fall in line, and from now on you won't have the problems, the worries, the gnawing lump of anxiety that perhaps you've experienced before. Doubt, fear, well, they'll be things of the past. Here's the key to success and the key to failure. We become what we think about. Now, let me say that again. We become what we think about. Throughout all history, the great wise men and teachers, philosophers and prophets have disagreed with one another on many different things. It's only on this one point that they are in complete and unanimous agreement. Listen to what Marcus Aurelius, the great Roman emperor, said. A man's life is what his thoughts make of it. Disraeli said this, "Everything comes if a man will only wait. I've brought myself by long meditation to the conviction that a human being with a settled purpose must accomplish it, and that nothing can resist a will that will stake even existence for its fulfillment." Ralph Waldo Emerson said this, "A man is what he thinks about all day long." William James said, "The greatest discovery of my generation is that human beings can alter their lives by altering their attitudes of mind." And he also said, "We need only in cold blood act as if the thing in question were real, and it will become infallibly real by growing into such a connection with our life that it will become real. It will become so knit with habit and emotion that our interests in it will be those which characterize belief." And he also said, "If you only care enough for a result, you will almost certainly attain it. If you wish to be rich, you will be rich. If you wish to be learned, you will be learned. If you wish to be good, you will be good. Only you must then really wish these things and wish them exclusively and not wish at the same time 100 other incompatible things just as strongly." In the Bible, you read in Mark 9:23, "If thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth." My old friend Dr. Norman Vincent Peale put it this way, "This is one of the greatest laws in the universe. Fervently do I wish I had discovered it as a very young man. It dawned upon me much later in life, and I found it to be one of the greatest, if not my greatest discovery outside of my relationship to God. The great law, briefly and simply stated, is that if you think in negative terms, you will get negative results. If you think in positive terms, you will achieve positive results. That is the simple fact," he went on to say, "which is at the basis of an astonishing law of prosperity and success. In three words, believe and succeed." William Shakespeare put it this way, "Our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win by fearing to attempt." George Bernard Shaw said, "People are always blaming their circumstances for what they are. I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want, and if they can't find them, make them." Well, that's pretty apparent, isn't it? And every person who discovered this for a while believed that he was the first one to work it out. We become what we think about. Now, it stands to reason that a person who's thinking about a concrete and worthwhile goal is going to reach it, because that's what he's thinking about, and we become what we think about. Conversely, the man who has no goal, who doesn't know where he's going, and whose thoughts must therefore be thoughts of confusion and anxiety and fear and worry, becomes what he thinks about. His life becomes one of frustration and fear and anxiety and worry. And if he thinks about nothing, he becomes nothing. Now, how does it work? Why do we become what we think about? Well, I'll tell you how it works, as far as we know. Now, to do this, I want to tell you about a situation that parallels the human mind. Suppose a farmer has some land, and it's good, fertile land. Now, the land gives the farmer a choice. He may plant in that land whatever he chooses. The land doesn't care. It's up to the farmer to make the decision. Now, remember, we're comparing the human mind with the land because the mind, like the land, doesn't care what you plant in it. It will return what you plant, but it doesn't care what you plant. Now, let's say that the farmer has two seeds in his hand. One is a seed of corn. The other is nightshade, a deadly poison. He digs two little holes in the earth, and he plants both seeds, one corn, the other nightshade. He covers up the holes, waters, and takes care of the land, and what will happen? Invariably, the land will return what's planted. As it's written in the Bible, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. Now remember, the land doesn't care. It'll return poison in just as wonderful abundance as it will corn. So up come the two plants, one corn, one poison. Now, the human mind is far more fertile, far more incredible and mysterious than the land, but it works the same way. It doesn't care what we plant. Success, failure. A concrete, worthwhile goal, or confusion. Misunderstanding, fear, anxiety, and so on. But what we plant, it must return to us. You see, the human mind is the last great unexplored continent on Earth. It contains riches beyond our wildest dreams. It will return anything. We want to plant. Now, you might say, well, if that's true, why don't people use their minds more? Well, I think they've figured out an answer to that one, too. Our mind comes as standard equipment at birth. It's free, and things that are given to us for nothing, we place little value on. Things that we pay money for, we value. The paradox is that exactly the reverse is true. Everything that's really worthwhile in life came to us free. Our minds, our souls, our bodies, our hopes, our dreams, our ambitions, our intelligence, our love of family and children and friends and country, all these priceless possessions are free. But the things that cost us money are actually very cheap and can be replaced at any time. A good man can be completely wiped out and make another fortune. He can do that several times. Even if our home burns down, we can rebuild it. But the things we got for nothing, we can never replace. The human mind isn't used because we take it for granted. Familiarity breeds contempt. It can do any kind of job we assign to it, but generally speaking, we use it for little jobs instead of big, important ones. Universities have proved that most of us are operating on about 10% or less of our abilities. So decide now. What is it you want? Plant your goal in your mind. It's the most important decision you ever make in your entire life. What is it you want? Do you want to be an outstanding salesman? A better worker at your particular job? Do you want to go places in your company, in your community? Do you want to get rich? All you've got to do is plant that seed in your mind, care for it, work steadily toward your goal, and it will become a reality. It not only will, there's no way that it cannot. You see, that's a law, like the laws of Sir Isaac Newton, the laws of gravity. If you get on top of a building and jump off, you'll always go down. You'll never go up. And it's the same with all the other laws of nature. They always work. They're inflexible. Think about your goal in a relaxed, positive way. Picture yourself in your mind's eye as having already achieved this goal. See yourself doing the things you will be doing when you've reached your goal. Ours has been called the phenobarbital age, the age of ulcers and nervous breakdowns and tranquilizers, at a time when medical research has raised us to a new plateau of good health and longevity. Far too many of us worry ourselves into an early grave, trying to cope with things in our own little personal ways, without learning a few great laws that will take care of everything for us. These things we bring on ourselves through our habitual way of thinking. Every one of us is the sum total of his own thoughts. He is where he is because that's exactly where he really wants to be, whether he'll admit that or not. Each of us must live off the fruit of his thoughts in the future, because what you think today and tomorrow, next month and next year, will mold your life and determine your future. You're guided by your mind. I remember one time I was driving through eastern Arizona and I saw one of those giant earth-moving machines roaring along the road at about 35 miles an hour with what looked like 30 tons of dirt in it. A tremendous, incredible machine. And there was a little man perched way up on top with the wheel in his hands guiding it. And as I drove along, I was struck by the similarity of that machine to the human mind. Just suppose you're sitting at the controls of such a vast source of energy. Are you going to sit back and fold your arms and let it run itself into a ditch? Or are you going to keep both hands firmly on the wheel and control and direct this power to a specific, worthwhile purpose? It's up to you. You're in the driver's seat. You see, the very law that gives us success is a two-edged sword. We must control our thinking. The same rule that can lead a man to a life of success, wealth, happiness, and all the things he ever dreamed of for himself and his family. That very same law can lead him into the gutter. It's all in how he uses it, for good or for bad. This is the strangest secret in the world. Now, why do I say it's strange, and why do I call it a secret? Actually, it isn't a secret at all. It was first promulgated by some of the earliest wise men, and it appears again and again throughout the Bible, but very few people have learned it, understand it. That's why it's strange, and why for some equally strange reason it virtually remains a secret. I believe that you could go out and walk down the main street of your town and ask one man after another what the secret of success is, and you probably wouldn't run into one man in a month who could tell you. Now, this information is enormously valuable to us if we really understand it and apply it. It's valuable to us not only for our own lives, but the lives of those around us, our families, employees, associates, and friends. Life should be an exciting adventure. It should never be a bore. A man should live fully, be alive. He should be glad to get out of bed in the morning. He should be doing a job he likes to do because he does it well. One time I heard Grove Patterson, the great late editor-in-chief of the Toledo Daily Blade, make a speech. And as he concluded his speech, he said something I've never forgotten. He said, "My years in the newspaper business have convinced me of several things. Among them, that people are basically good, and that we came from someplace, and we're going someplace. So we should make our time here an exciting adventure. The architect of the universe didn't build a stairway leading nowhere." And the greatest teacher of all, the carpenter from the plains of Galilee, gave us the secret time and time again. "As ye believe, so shall it be done unto you." I've explained the strangest secret in the world and how it works. Now, on this side, I want to explain how you can prove to yourself the enormous returns possible in your own life by putting this secret to a practical test. I want you to make a test that will last 30 days. It isn't going to be easy, but if you'll give it a good try, it will completely change your life for the better. Now, back in the 17th century, Sir Isaac Newton, the English mathematician and natural philosopher, gave us some natural laws of physics which apply as much to human beings as they do to the movement of bodies in the universe. And one of these laws is that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Simply stated, as it applies to you and me, it means we can achieve nothing without paying the price. The results of your 30-day experiment will be in direct proportion to the effort you put forth. To be a doctor, you must pay the price of long years of difficult study. To be successful in selling, and remember that each of us succeeds to the extent of his ability to sell, selling our families on our ideas, selling education in schools, selling our children on the advantages of living the good and honest life, selling our associates and employees on the importance of being exceptional people, to, of course, the profession of selling itself. But to be successful in selling our way to the good life, we must be willing to pay the price. Now, what is that price? Well, it's many things. First, it's understanding emotionally, as well as intellectually, that we literally become what we think about, that we must control our thoughts if we're to control our lives. It's understanding fully that, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. Second, it's cutting away all fetters from the mind and permitting it to soar as it was divinely designed to do. It's the realization that your limitations are self-imposed and that the opportunities for you today are enormous beyond belief. It's rising above narrow-minded pettiness and prejudice. And third, it's using all your courage to force yourself to think positively on your own problem, to set a definite and clearly defined goal for yourself, to let your marvelous mind think about your goal from all possible angles, to let your imagination speculate freely upon many different possible solutions, to refuse to believe that there are any circumstances sufficiently strong to defeat you in the accomplishment of your purpose, to act promptly and decisively when your course is clear, and to keep constantly aware of the fact that you are, at this moment, standing in the middle of your own acres of diamonds, as Russell Conwell used to point out. And fourth, save at least 10% of every dollar you earn. It's also remembering that no matter what your present job, it has enormous possibilities if you're willing to pay the price. Now let's just go over the important points in the price each of us must pay to achieve the wonderful life that can be ours. It is, of course, worth any price. 1. You will become what you think about. 2. Remember the word imagination and let your mind begin to soar. 3. Courage. Concentrate on your goal every day. 4. Save 10% of what you earn. And 5. Action. Ideas are worthless unless we act on them. Now, I'll try to outline the 30-day test I want you to make. Keep in mind that you have nothing to lose by making this test and everything you could possibly want to gain. There are two things that may be said of everyone. Each of us wants something, and each of us is afraid of something. I want you to write on a card what it is you want more than anything else. It may be more money. Perhaps you'd like to double your income or make a specific amount of money. It may be a beautiful home. It may be success at your job. It may be a particular position in life. It could be a more harmonious family. Each of us wants something. Now write down on your card specifically what it is you want. Make sure it's a single goal and clearly defined. You needn't show it to anyone, but carry it with you so that you can look at it several times a day. Think about it in a cheerful, relaxed, positive way each morning when you get up. And immediately you have something to work for, something to get out of bed for, something to live for. Look at it every chance you get during the day and just before going to bed at night. And as you look at it, remember that you must become what you think about. And since you're thinking about your goal, you realize that soon it will be yours. In fact, it's yours really the moment you write it down and begin to think about it. Look at the abundance all around you as you go about your daily business. You have as much right to this abundance as any other living creature. It's yours for the asking. Now we come to the difficult part. Difficult because it means the formation of what is probably a brand new habit, and new habits are not easily formed. Once formed, however, it will follow you for the rest of your life. Stop thinking about what it is you fear. Each time a fearful or negative thought comes into your consciousness, replace it with a mental picture of your positive and worthwhile goal. And there'll come times when you feel like giving up. It's easier for a human being to think negatively than positively. That's why only 5% are successful. You must begin now to place yourself in that group. For 30 days, you must take control of your mind. It will think about only what you permit it to think about. Each day for this 30-day test, do more than you have to do. In addition to maintaining a cheerful, positive outlook, give of yourself more than you've ever done before. Do this knowing that your returns in life must be in direct proportion to what you give. The moment you decide on a goal to work toward, you're immediately a successful person. You are then in that rare and successful category of people who know where they're going. Out of every 100 people, you belong to the top 5. Don't concern yourself too much with how you're going to achieve your goal. Leave that completely to a power greater than yourself. All you have to do is know where you're going. The answers will come to you of their own accord and at the right time. Remember these words from the Sermon on the Mount, and remember them well. Keep them constantly before you this month of your test. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knocketh, it shall be opened. It's as marvelous and as simple as that. In fact, it's so simple that in our seemingly complicated world, it's difficult for an adult to understand that all he needs is a purpose and faith. For 30 days, do your very best. If you're a salesman, go at it as you've never done before, not in a hectic fashion, but with the calm, cheerful assurance that time well spent will give you the abundance in return you deserve and want. If you're a homemaker, devote your 30-day test to completely giving of yourself without thinking about receiving anything in return, and you'll be amazed at the difference it makes in your life. No matter what your job, do it as you've never done it before for 30 days. And if you've kept your goal before you every day, you'll wonder and marvel at this new life you've found. Dorothea Brand, the outstanding editor and writer, discovered it for herself and tells about it in her fine book, Wake Up and Live. Her entire philosophy is reduced to the words, act as though it were impossible to fail. She made her own test with sincerity and faith, and her entire life was changed to one of overwhelming success. Now, You make your test for 30 full days. Don't start your test until you've made up your mind to stick with it. You see, by being persistent, you're demonstrating faith. Persistence is simply another word for faith. If you didn't have faith, you'd never persist. If you should fail during your first 30 days, by that I mean suddenly find yourself overwhelmed by negative thoughts, you've got to start over again from that point and go 30 more days. Gradually, your new habit will form until you find yourself one of that wonderful minority to whom virtually nothing is impossible. And don't forget the card. It's vitally important as you begin this new way of living. On one side of the card, write your goal, whatever it may be. On the other side, write the words we've quoted from the Sermon on the Mount. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. Nothing great was ever accomplished without inspiration. See that during these crucial first 30 days, your own inspiration is kept at a peak. And above all, don't worry. Worry brings fear, and fear is crippling. The only thing that can cause you to worry during your test is trying to do it all yourself. Know that all you have to do is hold your goal before you. Everything else will take care of itself. Remember also to keep calm and cheerful. Don't let petty things annoy you and get you off course. Now, since making this test is difficult, some will say, why should I bother? Well, look at the alternative. No one wants to be a failure. No one really wants to be a mediocre individual. No one wants a life constantly filled with worry and fear and frustration. Therefore, remember that you must reap that which you sow. If you sow negative thoughts, your life will be filled with negative things. If you sow positive thoughts, your life will be cheerful, successful, and positive. Now, gradually, you will have a tendency to forget what you've heard on this recording. Play it often. Keep reminding yourself of what you must do to form this new habit. Gather your whole family around at regular intervals and listen to what's been said here. You know, most men will tell you that they want to make money without understanding the law. The only people who make money work in a mint. The rest of us must earn money. This is what causes those who keep looking for something for nothing or a free ride to fail in life. The only way to earn money is by providing people with services or products which are needed and useful. We exchange our time and our product or service for the other man's money. Therefore, the law is that our financial return will be in direct proportion to our service. Now, success is not the result of making money. Making money is the result of success, and success is in direct proportion to our service. Most people have this law backwards. They believe that you're successful if you earn a lot of money. The truth is that you can only earn money after you're successful. It's like the story of the man who sat in front of the stove and said to it, give me heat, and then I'll add the wood. How many men and women do you know, or do you suppose there are today, who take the same attitude toward life? There are millions. We've got to put the fuel in before we can expect heat. Likewise, we've got to be of service first before we can expect money. Don't concern yourself with the money. Be of service. Build, work, dream, create. Do this and you'll find there's no limit to the prosperity and abundance that will come to you. Prosperity, you know, is founded upon a law of mutual exchange. Any person who contributes to prosperity must prosper in turn himself. Sometimes the return will not come from those you serve, but it must come to you from someplace, because that's the law. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. As you go daily through your 30-day test period, remember that your success will always be measured by the quality and quantity of service you render, and money is a yardstick for measuring this service. No man can get rich himself unless he enriches others. Now, there are no exceptions to a law. You can drive down any street in America and from your car estimate the service that's being rendered by the people living on that street. Had you ever thought of this yardstick before? It's interesting. Some, like ministers and priests and other devoted people, measure their returns in the realm of the spiritual. But again, their returns are equal to their service. Once this law is fully understood, any thinking person can tell his own fortune. If he wants more, he must be of more service to those from whom he receives his return. If he wants less, he has only to reduce his service. This is the price you must pay for what you want. If you believe you can enrich yourself by deluding others, you can end only by deluding yourself. It may take some time, but just as surely as you breathe, you'll get back what you put out. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking you can avert this. It's impossible. The prisons and the streets where the lonely walk are filled with people who tried to make new laws just for themselves. We may avoid the laws of man for a while, but there are greater laws that cannot be broken. An outstanding medical doctor recently pointed out 6 steps that will help you realize success. 1, set yourself a definite goal. 2, quit running yourself down. 3, stop thinking of all the reasons why you cannot be successful and instead think of all the reasons why you can. 4, trace your attitudes back through your childhood and try to discover where you first got the idea you couldn't be successful, if that's the way you've been thinking. 5, change the image you have of yourself by writing out a description of the person you would like to be. And 6, act the part of the successful person you have decided to become. The doctor who wrote those words is a noted West Coast psychiatrist, Dr. David Harold Fink. Do what the experts since the dawn of recorded history have told you you must do. Pay the price by becoming the person you want to become. It's not nearly as difficult as living unsuccessfully. Make your 30-day test, then repeat it again, and each time it will become more a part of you until you'll wonder how you could ever have lived any other way. Live this new way and the floodgates of abundance will open and pour over you more riches than you may have dreamed existed. Money? Yes, lots of it. But what's more important, you'll have peace. You'll be in that wonderful minority who lead calm, cheerful, successful lives. Start today. You have nothing to lose, but you have a whole life to win. This is Earl Nightingale, and thank you.
Well, you're about to discover, maybe for the first time in your life, that wealth is not money, and money's not wealth. Real estate's not wealth either. Neither is gold or silver. What is wealth? I believe that wealth is one thing. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. That's what wealth is. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. And so the more we develop our ability to create value for other people, the more wealthy we are. And the reason I say money's not wealth, think about it like this. If you were stuck on a desert island and you had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash, what would it be worth? Nothing, right? If you're stranded there, nobody knows you're there, nobody can find you, all that money doesn't do you any good. If you're there with another person, and they have food, and you have water, and they have no water, and you have no food, then your water becomes your wealth because you can trade them some of your water for some of your food. Are y'all tracking? And so everything that we desire, we get by giving somebody else something they desire. The more value we create for other people, the more wealth we have. It's just that simple. Now, money is one of the stores of value. That's what money is. Money is a store of value, and it's also a way to transfer value. It's also a way to represent value that you've already created, right? So if you think about money as like a certification, right? Like it's a certificate that proves that you've created value for someone other than yourself, right? And so, like, if you go to Eddie V's and you're a nice person, right? And you say, well, I would like for y'all to serve me some food. They are going to say, okay, we'll serve you some food, but at the end, they expect you to produce proof that you serve somebody other than you. And that proof shows up in the way of money, right? Because that's all money does. Money shows people that you deserve to have somebody create value for you because you can prove you created value for someone else, right? And here's what's really cool. All of us are good at different things. So we all have different value that we can create for other people, and if we keep the value that we create to ourselves, it doesn't really do us that much good. But if we spread the value, the value that we create for other people, if we spread that around, then it becomes more valuable. Now here's what's really interesting. I can't create value for someone until I know what's valuable to that someone. So wealth creation has like a lot to do with discovery, like discovering what other people value. And if I'm going to know what other people value, then I got to know where do those values come from? Like, where do values come from? There are things you value that I don't value. There are things I value that you don't value, right? And there are things that we both value, but you might value more than me or I might value more than you. Huh. So where do our values come from? Okay, I believe the first place that values come from is past, perceived, I'm just going to do P-E-R-C, perceived voids create present pursued values. Are y'all tracking? Past perceived voids create present pursued values. What does that mean? That means if I feel like something was missing in the past, I will work in the present to fill the void that I had in the past, right? So that's why if people grow up in a place where they're in like dire hunger conditions or feast or famine, they value food like at a very high level, right? That's why people who, so for me, like I like cars. I like them. I like cars. I grew up working on cars, right? But I grew up in a family where when I was growing up, my parents never bought a new car ever. They had seven boys. Here's what boys do. They eat you out of house and home, right? Boys can just, it's like they're a bottomless food pit, right? And I can remember, like, if I was in elementary school, if I was going to eat a sandwich, I wouldn't eat a sandwich. I'd eat two, three, or four sandwiches, right? So, but I like cars. And so we grew up with buying $50 cars, $100 cars, and then working on them and driving them until they broke down. Then we go buy another $50 car, $100 car, and we had no car payments, right? So I like cars. I used to see people with nice cars. I'm like, why do they have nice cars? We don't have nice cars, right? So that's a past perceived void in my life, right? So it became a present pursued value. Some people like, why do you have all these expensive cars? Well, expensive is a relative term anyway. I don't even, like, that's really relative. Like, it depends on, like, what is expensive to you, right? So, but the reason I, like, have a collection of, I say a collection, I've got some very nice cars is because I like cars, because that was, for me, a past perceived void. I work out. Why do I work out? Because in the past, I've been out of shape. And in the past, my body hurt. The more out of shape I was, the more my body hurt. So that's a past perceived void that created a present pursued value. Are y'all tracking? And so a lot of times we don't even know where these things that we value came from, right? I value entrepreneurship. Why? Because in the past I used to have jobs, and they always came with a boss. And I don't know. The word boss means, like, they're going to be bossing me around. That's what, like, they're going to tell me, like, can I go? No. And I can't even finish the question, right? Can I have? No. And I don't like to have to ask for permission. I don't like permission. In fact, the best way to get me to do something is to tell me I can't do it. I'm that dude, okay? I know none of you entrepreneurs are that way, right? So you started business because you love people telling you what to do. Okay. Judgment-free zone. And so I like autonomy. My parents, great parents, they weren't perfect parents by any stretch of imagination, which is why I did not become a perfect parent. Okay, so but they were great parents for me and my brothers, right? And they were very authoritarian. Like it didn't matter if I was 7 or 17. Why? The answer was always going to be the same, because I said so. Right. So I liked autonomy. So when I wasn't at home, I didn't like teachers telling me what to do at school. I didn't like my parents telling me what to do at home. And then I got a job, and the boss wanted to tell me, and everybody wanted to tell me what to do. And I know it's my own little weirdness going on in my mind palace, but like you got yours, I got mine, and I don't like people telling me what to do. So I want to live as autonomous. Now I want God to tell me what to do, but I don't like humans bossing me around. Okay, because their motive is suspect. God's motive is not suspect, right? Right? And that's why I don't like it when people on my team call me, oh, this is my boss. I'm not your boss. I don't even like the word boss. I don't have an outfit that matches a boss. You don't have an outfit that matches a boss. So unless we're talking about business optimization success secrets from Boss Moves, then again, that's a different story. But not bossing people around. Anyway, so y'all get it. Past perceived voids create present pursued values. But also, the second place values come from, Second place values come from is present, pursued. I don't think I spelled that right. Pursued victories create present pursued values. So present pursued victories, the things I'm working towards winning right now, will cause me to value that thing. And so I've got to value. I want to win. So because I want to win, okay, for instance, I'm going to put my son-in-law on blast. So my son-in-law, I mean, we're really, really close until we get on the golf course, and then we try to beat each other's brains out. It's great. Okay? So he wants to beat me really, really bad. I want to beat him really, really bad. And for a while, I just beat him all the time. And then, like, I lost my mojo, and then he beat me all the time. And he was sending his mom text messages like, there's a new sheriff in town. And then his mom would call me, and I'm like, is this really happening? Okay, cool. So I started working on my short game again. And so now it's like the last three tournaments we've had, we play three-round tournaments, and we have this trophy. And every time you win three rounds, you get to put your name on the trophy. No, it's not on the news. It's not on ESPN. Nobody knows but us. But we relish this victory so much, right? And so what we do, because we both want to win, is we both spend time working on our game, because present pursued victories create present values. So the things that we felt like we're missing in the past, that creates value for us. The things that we're working on winning in the present, and then the last one is future pursued. I think I spelled that right. I don't know. Pursued.
Can you hear me? There's no sound. I don't hear you, LA. I don't know what's going on.
Well, you're about to discover, maybe for the first time in your life, that wealth is not money, and money's not wealth. Real estate's not wealth either. Neither is gold or silver. What is wealth? I believe that wealth is one thing. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. That's what wealth is. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. And so the more we develop our ability to create value for other people, the more wealthy we are. And the reason I say money's not wealth, think about it like this. If you were stuck on a desert island and you had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash, what would it be worth? Nothing, right? If you're stranded there, nobody knows you're there, nobody can find you, all that money doesn't do you any good. If you're there with another person and they have food and you have water and they have no water and you have no food, then your water becomes your wealth because you can trade them some of your water for some of your food. Are y'all tracking? And so everything that we desire, we get.
Okay, we had a slight technical difficulty, which apparently has been resolved. So, good morning, Viata. What do you have for us today?
Good morning, LA, and all your great listeners. And I think it's really interesting the way he describes wealth, because I've never really heard it described that way. So is this the same guy you had on yesterday?
Yep, Myron Golden, Tampa, Florida.
You said Myron?
Yeah, Myron Golden, and he lives in Tampa, Florida.
Okay. So he's an entrepreneur, right?
He certainly is.
And he must be wealthy on YouTube, right?
Before YouTube and additionally on YouTube, yes.
Yeah, so you know how many followers he has? Are they
I can check that. I can check that real quick. I know he's got some YouTube videos on how to build. Everything he does is basically Bible based. But I mean, he's very practical with it. Let's see, Myron Golden.
Okay. I just think it's interesting because I've never heard anybody describe wealth as looking at the value you create for others than yourself, because wealth to me in the past may be more and more relevant. Maybe it'd be interesting what your listeners think. Wealth has usually been determined on the value you place on you and the things that you need, what you need in your life. But I can understand and relate to this new definition, value you create for other people.
Over 500,000 subscribers.
Okay, so he's not up there in the millions, but so he's got a lot of people listening to him, but he's only one person, one story. And I'm glad you brought up value today. And as I mentioned yesterday, I'm in a buyer's club with Melaleuca Company, where I see value as very important to discuss and have conversations with people who want to join the buyer's club. Because what do I value? Consumer. I think that's what all of us have in common. We're all consumers, right? And
you're going to spend
your money on what you value, right? I mean, you're not going to buy something you don't value, right?
That's correct, yeah. Although a lot of us spend money on stuff that is valueless.
Okay. So
but that's another podcast.
Let's look at a car, for instance. I believe cars are the worst investment. New cars, okay? Everybody, some people need it. We all need a vehicle to get around long distance, right, or some type of vehicle. But new cars, to me, are the worst investment. Now, my son, on the other hand, bought a new car. He just bought a new car. He got a loan for a new car. Because his other car had over 150,000 miles on it. I had helped him repair quite a few things on that car. So I put invested money in his car, but he started hearing a noise in the car. So he transports two children around everywhere in the Central Florida area, whether it's dance class, school. He's a divorced parent, and he has to pick up his kids, travel around. So I think his concern was that this old car was going to break down, and he didn't want that to happen with the children and all that. So he bought a new car. And again, unless you have that type of responsibility, that type of lifestyle where you're transport, and he works all the way across town for a company, so his commute every day is about 30 minutes or more. And he doesn't go into work every day. But anyway, he puts a value on a new car because of his lifestyle, right?
Yep.
So my
and mobility. Mobility,
yeah.
The way I look at it, mobility is a form of wealth. A lot of people don't look at it that way, but it's a form of wealth. I mean, how to get from A to B.
Well,
and
yeah,
then how important is it for you to get to A to B? And how often do you need to get from A to B?
Well, that's the point we're making. This guy was talking about wealth is what's the value you put on other people, but we're talking about value, personal value is wealth, okay?
Yeah, and that's very subjective, person to person.
Yeah, that's why people like Myron, I listen to them for a few minutes, and I'm like, well, okay, there's some truth there. You know, I hear what he's saying, but my lifestyle, my family's lifestyle, may not be relevant to what he's saying, or I might not, resonate with what he's saying for me and my lifestyle. But I began to think, when I joined Melaleuca, I joined at the beginning of the year, and I got a dollar off because they have a promotion for a dollar. Instead of $19 a year, you can pay a dollar a year to join this, what I say is a buyer's club. But I start looking at what do I value, because they have thousands of products they offer that are better and less toxic than the average product. And I had to start thinking, well, what do I value? Because I'm not going to be ordering, you know, all these products every month just to meet the minimum. I had to think about what do I personally value. So as I'm having conversations with you and my friends, that's the question we ask people. What do you value? Because you may not value what I value. So, for instance, you, L.A., what do you value that you would even want to become a member of a buyer's club where you can get your products that you consume on a regular basis? They're not going to be the same as mine. For instance, I value essential oils. I use them all over my tiny house because it helps keep mildew and mold away. I use them on my body for deodorant. I don't have a deodorant. I use essential oils. I make my own. I use them for pain. I use them for just about in my diffuser to make the air smell better. So I found out with this company, I can meet my minimum order just buying a couple of few bottles of essential oils every month. So then
okay.
You, as another consumer, what would you value?
Well, I was looking at the online catalog this morning. So particularly with that company, I haven't decided what I even want. Or would want out of, you know, because there's a lot of products there. But
right.
Values also depend for every person, they change from time to time. What you
exactly.
might value today might not be what you value tomorrow.
Right, I agree. But there are still products, if you look at your grocery list every month, there are products you're buying every month, food mainly. Other than food, or even including food, like if you have a protein shake, you're going to buy that every month, right?
Yeah, but I make my own shakes.
So that's not something you need then. Other
right.
people who are working 8-hour job, 9-to-5 jobs, they might buy a protein shake already made so they can just throw it in the blender and be on their way, carry
right.
it with them. So that's something eat every month.
Like
they offer
a lot of products. They offer a lot of products. So I'm looking through it to see what I value that I really can't get anywhere else. That's my mindset right now.
Exactly. And see, for me, Chamberlain's, my favorite health food store, closed in my neighborhood. So that reduced my options for shopping for my essential oils and all my or stuff. Even though Publix, which is in Florida, is an excellent grocery store for just about everything, I don't have a car. So I don't want to be making Jeff Bezos richer, and I don't want to pay for Prime. And this company, Melaleuca, I got my order in 3 days. I placed an order for the initial package. I got it in 3 days. Everything came in. I started sharing it with my friends. But Amazon, you got to pay for that kind of service. And it doesn't always get here, like they say, in 1 day. So I look at the comparing value, wealth, and all that. Do you want to keep placing value or your money in places like Amazon that doesn't pay you a profit share, and Walmart too? We used to think Walmart was the place to go to get cheaper items, right, or less expensive items. I don't think that's happening anymore. I went in there.
But
to
also,
get
now, hold it. Now, when you're looking at value, okay, there's some other. Now, you brought this up when we were up at the 4 Acres up in Jasper. Okay, people, particularly in this economy in the United States, actually anywhere, value could be is not just price alone. It could be also in comfort and convenience. Walmart
yeah.
is convenient. You know, I'm surrounded by three of them.
Okay.
And they're all about the same distance away from my front door. So
right.
if
okay.
I want something today or right now, you know, hey, 10, 15 minutes from here, I'm at Walmart, Thrill. So convenience, that's a value factor. Now, now with Amazon, you know, when I order something from them, if it's not going to be there the next day, and they typically tell you about when it's going to be because you can track it. You know, some stuff might be 5 days, 2 days, next day, whatever it might be. But you typically know that in advance with M. But once again, price, comfort, convenience, you got to factor those all into what it's valuable to a individual person. And let me throw in another element, personality. Now, due to your personality, that's why we're having this conversation right now, because we're marketing. However, I like your personality. Expertise. So I said, oh, you know, let me take a second look at this. So you got it. I value the personality and all those other elements I just mentioned. It's about, I got four metrics on value.
Okay. So value for me is good customer service. That's why I love Publix. I always get help. People are in the aisles. Can I help you? Anytime you need help, people are right there. They're always pleasant. They don't, if you return something, you don't need a receipt. They just, you return, okay, here's your money. What do you want, credit? How do you want? Publix, grocery store, chain.
You don't need a receipt?
No. You don't need a receipt in Publix if you return.
All right, Walmart, you need a receipt. I know that.
So I'm going to compare Publix with Walmart. Walmart customer service sucks. I have always gone in. I'm chasing people around the store. Can you help me? And then they don't, maybe it's changed, but that's why I stay away from Walmart. I've had so many bad experiences with customer service in Walmart. I stay away from that store. And then it's just a real show to see people, how they, this is entertaining, nevertheless, to go in there and to watch people, how they dress, but the service is terrible. So now the prices have gone up at Walmart, and you ain't getting good service. Forget it. I'll never go back there if I don't have to, because why would I place value in a store that prices are higher and the customer service is poor? That's me now. Other people may not care. And I think all of us are going to get to that. Are we getting to that place where funding corporate interests, giving you some value in your life, why bother? Because these days you got to, you know, use your money wisely because of inflation. And if you're not getting value out of the places you shop, why would you want to invest in that? And, again, we're talking about what's value for you is different for me. But why would you invest in a company that's not giving you something back that's valuable, either service or good quality products or good prices? Forget it. So this company that I found, that I'm working, partnering with, you're going to get – I called them. I was wondering when my shipment was coming because it was like the third day, and I called them up, and they said, well, your box is in at your door. And I'm like, really? And sure enough, I go out there, and the box is at the door. It had already delivered it. So this – so far, it's been a month now that I've been with this company. I don't have any complaints. And I realized they sent me a variety of products in my first order just so I could try them and see. I don't need all these products, but they, I only got maybe 20 products, maybe more, of samples of the 1,000 products that they offer. And I realized out of those 20 products, maybe 3 or 4 that I could use on a regular basis. And then I just shared them with my friends to let them try them out and see how they like them and if they could use them even. So I don't use bar soap usually. I use liquid soap, but I got 2 bars of soap. I gave one to a friend, and my granddaughter loved the bar soap that I did get. So value. I'm by sharing these products with my friend, I'm finding out what they value. I have a young lady in my life who has allergies galore. She uses Lysol, hand sanitizers, and she has a lot of fear, too, in her life. She's afraid of bugs and lizards and all that kind of thing. So I said, okay, what can I share with her? I gave her a bottle of the disinfectant that they sent me. In fact, I diluted it because it's a concentrated. And I gave her a spray bottle. I said, would you mind trying this? See how you like it. Knowing that she needs it, but I don't want to say, well, you need this. You got. I said, could you try this for me and just tell me how you like it? So I haven't heard from her yet because it was just last week I gave her to try. But when you see people who are using regular hand sanitizers, Clorox, Lysol, they're damaging their bodies and their environment. That's toxic, toxic. And if you didn't hear my show this morning, we were talking about the suicide of a vice president of student affairs at Lincoln University and how she found herself in a toxic environment at her job. And she wasn't able to perceive that time for me to go, or it's time for me to leave this job, or it's time for me to take a break. She wasn't able to have that perspective or discernment, so she took her life. That really bothered me because my sister went to Lincoln, for one. So I had memories of being at that college in back about 20, 30 years ago, actually. And I thought, wow, and she, was the environment that bad? Well, evidently for her, it was a toxic environment. Bullying going on by the president. She said in a long email how she believed the president bullied her, even though she was already communicating to him and everybody that she had anxiety and depression she was dealing with. So we looked at that today on the show, and I looked at it personally saying, well, what type of environment internally was she dealing with? Because people are using all these toxic products, inhaling them, and then they're eating all this crappy food, processed food, sugar, whatever, and you kind of get a picture of someone that was in her position that she wasn't taking good care of herself. How about meditating, getting away from the job every day so that you don't have the anxiety and depression? That obviously wasn't happening with her because at the beginning of January, she decided she's going to just commit suicide. So thinking about just her story and what's her value was in her job. And when that was threatened, the president was terminating her and telling her that if she didn't leave, they were going to send the police to take her out of her apartment, blah, 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 blah. And it appeared from the information that she had a husband, but where was the husband? So you couldn't even see her placing value on her relationships outside of that job. And that's my point is, we have to, even though Myron was talking about value is what you create for other people, I think you got to first and foremost promote value for your own self and for your own mental health. So what do you think about that, Billy?
Well, you got to have a balance between the two. Because you don't get through this life as a solo act. You don't come in alone. You don't go out alone. And you're going to need people all in the middle. I think people, if you go with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, people just instinctively look out for number one. They look at what they value. Because if you look at it, every relationship that you again get into, particularly that is non-blood related, there is you're friends with that person, relationship with that person, marry that person, whatever. That person might be your boss or whatever employee. It's what's in it for me. If I get married with, if I get married to this particular woman or person, whatever the case may be, what's in it for me? You know, it sounds selfish, but that's the way the system is. Now, hopefully, you know, there can be a symbiotic relationship there, but, you know, relationships take all different. But everything, everybody looks at, I think, number one, what can they get out of it? Now, they might not think of it in those terms or say it like I just said it, but, you know, what am I getting out of it?
Well, absolutely, because you want to be in peace and you want to have some high vibration emotions like joy and happiness and love and all that. So I think that's what all of us should be discerning and judging when we have relationships is what am I getting out of this that's bringing me joy, peace, and happiness and, you know, not stress, right? You don't want to be in stress. But this woman was in a stressful relationship with her boss. And she had to be in a stressful relationship in that environment because even before she got her review, her performance review, she was talking about she was depressed and in anxiety. So we were discussing this morning. Person leaves another job. Why do you leave another job? And you take a better, maybe usually because you got a better pay, usually better position. So you like that position, that job, whatever. But then 4 or 5 months into the job, you have depression and anxiety? Okay, what's wrong with this picture? Then you, as I was saying, you need to look at your environment. You're not just your internal, your external, the stress around you. What's going on inside of you that you have stress and anxiety? That's the question we all have to ask and then make decisions. The psychology of adjustment, as my dad calls it, to bring peace back to your body, your mind. Because she had a mental illness is what you could term it. Mental illness is when you can't handle or you're stressed about your situation so much so that you're not performing your job well. And obviously she wasn't performing her job well according to not only the president of the university, but the people, some of the people in her department were claiming that she wasn't doing a good job, but because she got a really low rating on her performance. So when you get that type of feedback, okay, that not only are you stressed and depressed and anxiety, and then you get a performance review that says, you're not doing your job well. What is your response? Or do you react like she did and say, well, I'm just a victim because I told you I'm depressed and anxious. I'm a victim and you're a bully. That's what the situation turned out to look like. I'm a victim and you're a bully. Instead of taking responsibility for your stress, anxiety, depression that you're feeling, but you're not, you might have been medicating instead of educating, you turn out to say, well, you get a low, how many performance reviews have you gotten, LA, that were shining, just wonderful, and how many have you gotten that were not so great? I mean, we could all look at our job performances in the past. If you didn't probably didn't even have a job, did you?
Not where I was given a job.
What's that? I didn't hear you.
I said not where a written job review was part of the job. I never got one. I had never had a job.
Yeah. So if you ask
a performance review, I never had a job like that.
Right. That's what I remember. So if you'd ask people in your life who have had corporate jobs and they got reviews, how many of them were great and how many were not so great? And how did they respond or react to that? That's the question we were dealing with this morning when this woman got a really bad review and she got into victim mode real quick. Not oh, my goodness, what is this?
And that's probably why I don't have one of those jobs because I don't. Now, you do have to have good customer service. As an entrepreneur, you do need to provide good customer service. And you want a satisfied long-term customer. I understand that. And I take any, what I call, I don't look at it as criticism. I call it feedback. So I look at, you know, take the feedback, digest it, and then try to improve on what I'm doing. So that's about as close as I can get to what you're talking about. But in the kind of position that she's in, maybe she's not cut out to work for somebody else.
Well, she's gone right
maybe,
now.
Maybe she needs to start her own thing.
No,
I know she's dead now.
We're talking about
living. I mean, when she was living, you know, people that get in the victim mode, and I'm trying not to judge here, I think most of the people, that this, my opinion, because I'm not a mind reader, I don't know these people's true experience, I think a lot of people who get in the victim mode are basically unappreciative people, and they don't count the blessings that they have.
Well,
and, you know, that's a broad brush stroke, but, you know, that's my thought.
Let's just be honest. Since this is Black History Month, we got a lot of black folks who are in victim mode. You know, just the fact that we're still crying for reparations as we're victim mode. So we can be honest about that, living the black experience. Hey, this is Black History Month. Let's be honest. Living the black experience, we see a lot of our brothers and sisters who want to be in victim mode and cry blame and shame. The master, the slave master, the mama, the daddy, everybody you can point to, we want to blame and shame. That's why we have so many comorbidities in the black community, diabetes, cancer, obesity, because we are in victim mode instead of self-responsibility mode, taking self-responsibility, doing things differently than your mama and your daddy and your grandparents who were slaves, okay? So this is the reality. So unfortunately, this woman we talked about went right into victim mode when she got a bad review and started shaming. The president had took a leave of absence. I think he voluntarily took a leave because he was being blamed for her death. So how about that? You're gonna blame somebody. You're gone now. You done wrote a long email saying, I'm going to take my life, and you're to blame. Boom, I'm out of here. And then he's left with that burden. It's all you. Now, granted, he might need to make some corrections in his controlling behavior or his style of leadership, whatever. But, wow, big, big, big statement about somebody being in victim mode and blaming, leaving the blame and shame after you take your life on somebody else's shoulders.
Well, you know, there was a case, a criminal case, about maybe a couple years ago. If I look for the article I've seen this week in a video, there was a case where this woman was held criminally responsible for the death of an ex-boyfriend. The ex-boyfriend was broken up because she had, you know, dropped him.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then he called up trying to beg and plead, you know, try to get her back in. Then she was basically flipping about it and said, well, do what you get. I'm just paraphrasing here. Anyway, he killed himself. So some kind of way the DA's office charged her, I guess, with involuntary manslaughter of this guy, and she got convicted, which I thought was real crazy. I mean, because just like there's a case that was a shooting up in Michigan. This kid killed some classmates and somebody. Four people he killed. And they held his parents responsible also. Well, that's a whole other case. Let's keep it to this one thing. So with the suicide thing, some people think that way. I mean, the thing is, suicide is not even a solution. And
it's a temporary or a permanent.
If you call it that, it's a permanent, because, you know, the thing about life, and we both lived long enough to experience this, you can feel down to the dumps right now However, in a matter of moments, let alone seconds, you can get some good news or something can happen to you that can do a 180. So that's how I look at life.
Well, that's why they call it a permanent solution for a temporary problem or situation. You're right. We can look at the person who decides to leave their body that way, to me, is in divine order because it's already done and we have to learn the lessons from it. That's how I look at it. What are the lessons? They've already done it. It's done. The day, the hour was a divine appointment. That was when they were supposed to leave, how they were supposed to leave, all that divine order, in my opinion. So now we're here to say, what was the lesson in that? Because anybody who takes their life, they leave behind a lot of sorrow in people who love them and who cared for them. And some people never even get over it. So we're left behind to analyze it.
Yeah,
talk
I think
about
it's,
it.
It's, my whole philosophy is don't quit. No matter what it is, don't quit because anything can turn it around.
Yes. But, yeah, but her case is when you're in a toxic environment with toxic internal environment and toxic external environment and no relationships of good quality other than the people you work with who turn on you and don't even support you, blah, 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 and then you're taking a drug that has side effects of suicide. Ah. Too many factors that are going to take you right out of here. And so I'm grateful for her story today that has led us to talk about value. You don't value your own life anymore when you say, I'm out of here, I'm going to commit suicide. You don't have value for your own life. You have been manipulated by drugs and people and into a victim mind that says it's not worth it for me. Okay, here's the thing. It's not worth it for me to stay here any longer. She did not find value in this life any longer. And all the things you could read about her and learn about her that caused her to come to that conclusion are valuable for us to prevent that from happening in our lives or other people's lives. And that's the biggest lesson is listening to other people when you meet them to maybe prevent that. If maybe they just need you to listen to their story, and we can take away from her story, nobody was listening to her enough to say, don't take your life. Find value in this life so that you can stay around. But value, we're talking about value. She didn't find value in this life anymore for all the reasons.
Did you know Naima attempted suicide once?
No.
You didn't? Okay, you must. No. She was sharing the story. This is some years ago.
Oh,
this is
okay.
All way before we knew. She was a teenager.
Oh. Okay.
Next time
Naima.
Yeah, next time you talk to Naima, ask about it. She shared it on a female salute, I think, I don't know, 5 years ago or whatever it was. And she was a teenager.
I remember when I was like 11, I was about 11 years old, and I had this, my first love. His name was Myron Love, my first boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
I was head over heels. And then he jumped me. Yeah.
At 11?
I was in middle
okay.
school. I was in middle
okay.
school. He
All
jumped
right.
me for another. I thought I wanted to kill myself. I just a thought. And I looked at my wrist. And I thought I could just slit my wrist. I remember this so clearly because he was my first love. And I wrote about it in my diary. That's the other reason I remember it. I wrote about it in my diary. So, yeah, when you are immature spiritually and physically, suicide is an option, I think. Immaturity versus mature spirit focused. I have value in this life, and I'm going to see. I see value in my journey. I see value in my position. All that. That's a mature attitude. But even adults have immature perspective on what is valuable and what is not. And then you don't want to be here anymore. So,
well, you know, one thing to look at also is here's how I look at not only my life, but everybody's life. If you wake up in the morning or wake up at all, we're here where every one of us, this is my true belief, every one of us on the planet, we're here on assignment.
Exactly.
Power bigger than us that we can even comprehend, but we're on assignment. So that higher power gave us life, and we're here as a gift, because life is a gift, okay, and we're on assignment, and we have no right to terminate that assignment to quit before we're finished what we're supposed to be doing.
Well, some people's assignment is to commit suicide, unfortunately, because we learn lessons from that. And I say there's a scripture that says, the Creator says, I set before you death and life. Choose life so that you and your seed can live. Now, if people choose the death or the transition, I don't think it makes them a bad person. But like you just said, we all have an assignment. And some people have an assignment to teach us the dynamics around suicide. That's what her assignment was. She's gone now, and we're all here talking about it. Roland Martin did a whole show on this woman talking about, you know, the victim. Mostly, you know how Roland Martin rolls. He's the victim. Talk about what a bad victim she is. And then especially since her boss was white, he's going to bring out the race card. And it was racist, blah, blah, blah. And in fact, a lot of people are looking at her suicide in light of Claudine Gay, the Harvard president who resigned. They're looking at it in the way that shines light on black women in academia and how they're being segregated or they're pulling the race card on this. Because of the black women now lately who are having problems in academia. Discriminated is what I was looking for the word. How they're being discriminated against. When you look at, if you know the whole story, like you said, our assignment is to evolve. One of the things the Creator wants us to do is evolve, but then Creator gives us free will. So in the exercise of free will, some of us decide they're going to take their life with the help of Big Pharma giving you a drug that makes you think differently. So that may come into the pit. When you have free will to choose medication instead of meditation, medication over meditation can cause you to commit suicide, because that's one of the side effects. We're encouraging people to find value in your life where you join buying clubs like we're suggesting, melaleuca.com, where you find people who have similar interests as you, and you find a lifestyle that helps you meditate on why you're here and the value of your life to help other people, as he said in that audio you play. Wealth is value you create for other people. So that's another level of experiencing who you are when you start feeling, I'm wealthy, because look at all the value I'm creating for other people. And that's how I see Melaleuca Company. I'm going to create value for other people to see. Stop making Jeff Bezos richer. Stop going to Walmart where you don't get the service or the prices anymore that you should if you have value in yourself. And start using companies that are employing Americans more than China and who are providing you better quality services and better quality products that are not as toxic as some of the ones you find at Walmart or any other place. So we're talking about value and wealth, and we want to know, what do other people value? Because we can't create value for other people. We don't know what their value is, right? Where do they come from? and he said something like past perceived voids or something like that. So it means we got to have conversations, and that's why we're on Blog Talk Radio, to have conversations with our listeners to hear what their values are and then work to help them create that value and a more peaceful, wealthier life, because that's what I'm getting is I am very wealthy in the way that I'm creating value for other people and maintaining my own peace in meditation, not medication, and all those things. So I'm glad to share this information to create value for others as well. L.A., are you there?
I had my mic off, muted. So sorry about that. Obviously, you create value for many. You have the universe, or whatever you want to call it. Hey, that's why you got the airwaves on Friday and Sunday, because that's fulfilling part of your assignment.
Yes,
you have
Sunday,
children, you have grandchildren, and you're giving value to all of those people.
And I have 30 older
sister. You got a brother. So you give out, you provide value for quite a few people.
Sunday I'm gonna have Peggy, well known Buffalo. You might remember her from the Crow Reservation.
Yeah.
She's gonna be on Sunday to share about a new Centerpol coffee shop that is opening, and they're having a big event next week. So I'm excited about having her back on the show. We used to do a series of shows every week with her.
Every week, I remember that.
Unfortunately, I just heard that her son is still in prison. I can't believe this guy's still in prison for something he didn't even do. But we'll hear about that on Sunday. But I invite people to join me Sunday night, 8:00 Eastern, for Soul Purpose Healing with Peggy, well-known Buffalo, from the Crow Reservation in Montana. And I'm available.
That's
on,
one state I like
your...
to visit.
Yeah,
because I understand it's a very scenic state, particularly with the mountains and all that.
Well, I didn't see anything that exciting about it, but I was only in one part of it, and so it was nothing exciting. I was on the reservation for 5 days, and it was just like another town, plain reservation town for me. That's their lifestyle, and she has a beautiful place, the Center Pole, where she's doing a lot of good with homeless and child trafficking, working against that. And so she's a very unique personality that I'll be looking forward to talking to. So if anyone wants to join our Buyings Club, go to melaleuca.com. and check out the website. I think that's the first step to see the products that they offer and whether you see value in joining this buying club with us to make your life a little easier, a little less toxic and more convenient, and sharing with other people to help create value in their lives. So that's where we are, or that's where I am on this particular area. And my website is yourholisticlifecoach.com, where I just did some editing on it because I have a page on there for my dad, and I hadn't even put it in there that he transitioned in 2019. So I had to go in there and make some updates. And I made some updates that include a little information about Melaleuca and what I'm doing now on Blog Talk and staying busy creating value for myself and others.
Now, let me ask you this question, because people's values change.
Absolutely.
I mean, values can change like overnight.
Yeah.
So I'm figuring out, that's kind of hard to maintain in a relation, well, certain intimate relationships, because, hey, people's values change.
And I'm glad that's not interesting you brought it up. My dad was married to his wife for almost 40 years. And when they first met, he had an affair while he was on his second wife, but he ended up divorcing the second wife, marrying the third one. He told me that was his soulmate. They were in love, blah, blah, blah. She was 20 years younger than him. And he found value in her because that was his soulmate. They had more in common than his second and his first wife. They both were very athletic. And they had a son. She had a son. Boy, did that relationship change. Because both of them, my dad and his third wife, were raised in totally different environments. And trying to raise that son while he was retired and she was still working became a major conflict because their values in how to raise that son came out. He didn't have any sons. He had three daughters.
So their values changed when the son came along.
Yes, 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 yes. So they had a lot of
conflict. That's a good example, yeah.
The values.
So they went from, in your father's mind, they went from soulmates to married with children.
Exactly. Parents. You know, they went from soulmates, male, female, loving each other, traveling, doing that skiing and all that, to parent life, parenthood. Whoa, created more problems. She was an extreme.
Yeah, the values change.
Big time, big time. So that's just an example. And she was a real, I won't say hoarder, because they had a big house, but she managed to collect a lot of stuff in that house. And he was not that type. So all their beliefs that were different came out in that marriage. So that happens a lot with people who meet, fall in love, honeymoon, 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 and then boom, they have children and stress comes in. Why don't you get another job? Because we ain't making enough money to support to have a nice three-bedroom house with a garage and have kids and all that. Talk about value. You know, Americans, let's just talk a little bit about why tiny houses are valuable today.
Tiny houses are valuable to you and me, but there's a whole lot of people who they won't live in them because they think they're too small.
Until they have no choice.
Right. And even then, I know of a woman, she's mid-40s, and she has moved 10 different times in almost as many years. Not from house, from room to room in somebody else's house. But she won't have nothing to do with a tiny house or even a trailer.
When you have somebody who's that they have to keep moving around, they go from job to job, that's narcissistic energy behavior kind of, because they are not satisfied or content to be in one place or one job or one relationship for very long. That's one of the signs that a person has more they're on the spectrum of narcissism, on the extreme end or the other end versus mild-mannered narcissism. They can't stay in one house, one place, one relationship, or one job very long. They have to keep moving, keep moving, keep moving. So I don't know what you know about this person, but you probably find her to be a very controlling person and who has in survival mode all the time because of the trauma in their young life.
No, I don't know that much about her other than she's got a little church of her own, which is a small congregation, but like I said, go ahead.
Somebody mentioned Donald Trump, how Donald Trump is a narcissist and he's bad person, all that stuff. And I said, you know what? Yes. No, he is a narcissist, but I'd rather have a narcissist like him who keeps the peace around the world than some crazy fool like we got now and his administration that we bombing everybody and waiting to drop the next bomb. That's one thing Trump did for us. He kept us out of wars. Obama was bringing in new drones, dropping bombs everywhere, more wars. And this one's doing the same thing. I think the American people, not just American people, the average citizen is tired of wars. We don't see that as a sane solution for resolving problems anymore because we're all looking at the suffering in Palestine and Gaza. And we're like, what the fuck? Why is this still going on in 2024? Because we still got these idiot, maniac, psychopathic, elite Zionists running the show. So they talk about values. I think the last few months have demonstrated that most people across the globe are tired of war. We want to place value in human lives now. Let's place value in human lives, not the military-industrial complex, not our governments. Let's just wipe out these governments. Let's start all over again because they are useless to me or me, most people right now. They're not listening to the people who are saying ceasefire, stop the bombing, stop the war. We just had our government, the Congress, Johnson and all his people trying to push through another bill to give Ukraine and Israel more money. The war in Ukraine is over from what my sources are saying. They have lost the war. Ukraine has lost the war. So to put value in Ukraine by sending them money is insanity at this point. But that's the type of government we have. So we can look around and see what value our government places around the world and in running this country. Their value is in obeying the Zionists and doing what they're told, regardless of what people value, which is peace and human lives. So all these great lessons we're learning this year, I'm excited to be one who promotes value in human lives, creating non-toxic environments inside and out, and teaching people how to build wealth, not by, you know, focusing on how much money I can make, but like Myron said, showing value you create for other people. That's, to me, where the focus is to be.
Yeah. Well, give out the information for people interested in the Metaluca solution, and then we'll close it out for the day.
Metaluca.com, if you don't know how to spell that, it's MELALEUCA.com. Check out their website first, because if you look at all the products they offer, can this be a company you can order from every month, minimum order, that will give you value in your products and improve your environment inside and out? And can you help other people be a part of this buying club so that we can all prosper from the profit sharing that this company does? Melaleuca.com. And then go to my website, yourholistcoach.com, because I'm your coach. I'm the coach that will help you, number one, improve your health. That's what I do. My dad was a physical education instructor and a coach himself, football and all that. So I'm following his lead. I'm his legacy. And I'm not going to be watching the Super Bowl, by the way, even though he had a football life. Super Bowl, I could care less, really. But a lot of people will be watching that, but I'll be on Blog Talk Radio Sunday night, 8 o'clock every Sunday, bringing a spiritual adjustment for us to get in back into alignment with the Creator's wisdom and love and compassion, which this government and this medical system is not teaching any of that. No wisdom, no compassion, no love for self, none of that. It's all you be a victim and we'll help you with new drugs. So anyway, that's what I'm doing.
I got a question that just popped in my mind about suicide and pH. Levels in your body. Some, when my mother was living, this one morning, she was on the phone saying goodbyes to people like she was going to die. And I said, what in the hell? So I had just bought some Bragg's apple cider vinegar like a day before, just to have it in the house. Because I'm not a fan of vinegar myself, but just for medicinal reasons. And what I did was, I went and I broke out the Bragg's that I got from Chambers here in Lakeland, poured about a tablespoon, and then mixed it with some water, and then told her to drink it. She's still on the phone saying goodbye. And then I went in the backyard, and I cut a grapefruit. I picked the grapefruit off the tree, washed it, sliced it, gave her about a quarter of it, just a slice. And she ate that. And within 15 minutes, she did a 180. All that saying goodbye and, final goodbyes and all that went away, and just total different. So my question to you is, and then a couple other times when I saw her, maybe she was hungry or whatever. I remember one time I gave her a strawberry, just a strawberry. She ate it. And she was good. So my question is, would suicide have something to do with people's pH levels that, if it's too far down the line, what's the balance, 7 or whatever? If it's more acidic than alkaline in your body chemistry, you think that could, bring on those suicidal thoughts?
I have a chart that I use about pH. Because there's a book that I read years ago about pH. I can't remember the name of it, but it introduced me to that fact, that biology science about pH. Potential for hydrogen is what pH is. So hydrogen is what the majority of the sun energy is. The sun is made out of, mostly hydrogen. So it's kind of like the potential for hydrogen in your body is a reflection of how much of the sun's energy, okay, think about that, the life-giving light from the sun, how much of that is in your body or in the element you're measuring, pH. So pH is influenced by emotions more than anything else. If you give your mother, let's say a big salad, smoothie, and all the alkaline food that creates a high alkaline, because my sister used to drink alkaline water. We had a place that was selling alkaline water while she was trying to heal from breast cancer, and we were getting it by the gallon, alkaline water from this place, because I worked next door and they were giving it to me free because my sister was battling cancer, and she was drinking that by the gallon. But she was trying to overcome the death of a child, which I saw three major emotions working in her body: grief, unforgiveness, and guilt from the death of her child. All that alkaline water, all those salads, all the smoothies I was making, all the juicing we were doing fresh juices, and that cancer spread like wildfire in her breast, in her left breast. It almost didn't make a difference because she was in pain all the time because the cancer had just taken over her breast. And that was my biggest lesson about pH, is that what influences the alkalinity or acid in the body is the emotions. You have grief, unforgiveness, guilt. I'm sure your mother had all of them that she was dealing with every day. Then that is the acid energy that's going to be present in the body in the pH scale. But if you, on the other hand, you walk in forgiveness, peace, joy, dancing every day, loving yourself, accepting things, not regretting, you have understanding about, you reverence everything, you trust in your creator, have great relationships, your pH is going to be very alkaline when it comes to your emotions. And then if you could be eating hamburgers and french fries and steak and lots of bread, you're still going to have an alkaline pH because the emotions rule pH. That was my lesson from my sister, and I'm proving it in my own life. As long as I stay in forgiveness and joy, gratitude, forgiveness, and peace. There's a song I want your listeners to look up. It's called Thank You for the Sunshine. Thank you for sunshine. Thank you for rain. Thank you for joy. Thank you for pain. And it's this little African boy singing, and this white guy's playing the ukulele, and he's playing. It's just beautiful. My grandson loves the song. I played it for a guy who was in his 70s, and he said what got him was the thank you for pain. There's something inside of him, like he heard that, because gratitude is what heals the body, and forgiveness. When you hear a song like thank you for sunshine, thank you for rain, thank you for joy, thank you for pain, gratitude just fills your body, and that
gratitude goes a long way.
Alkaline pH. So what you were doing for your mother, and I applaud you, L.A. We've known each other through that challenge you were having with taking care of your mom. You were the best son anybody could ever have to be present in that time period for your mom, where she had lived a long, stressful career, and then in her retirement, her body was, like, really shutting down. But her emotions were still probably at a very low level of guilt, shame, fear, blame, regret, anxiety, all those low-frequency acid emotions. And so that everything you were doing for her was giving her temporary peace, but until she got into forgiveness, love, joy, joy, then that's why her body finally said, I'm out of here.
Yeah, her sister, which I told you this, she was one of seven. So she lived the longest out of her seven. No, the second longest out of all the siblings. She lived to 92. But the oldest sibling went 7 months before my mother, but was 13 years older than my mother. She lived to be 105. And one of the distinctions about her life was, it's about two or three of them. One, she ate off of like little teacup saucers. She would feed you like you on the front line of a football team, but she didn't eat that way. Next thing, she always worked. She didn't take any over-the-counter or prescription medication, but the biggest positive thing about her was she was always upbeat and positive.
Right.
You know, total opposite of my mother.
Yeah, that was an alkaline pH you were observing with her emotions.
Right.
That's the most
powerful. So she made it to 105.
Yeah, that's the most powerful energy to heal the body, is having high vibrating emotions of forgiveness and gratitude, especially forgiveness. People who hold on to unforgiveness, you're only hurting yourself.
Right. That's true. All right. Well, thank you, VR. See you on Sunday, at least on the feet, not 3 months. Well, you know, Soul Purpose Healing. Oh, wait, that's right. Today is Friday.
Yeah, it is. Boy, February's going fast, too.
Yeah, it is Friday. All right, on that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.